This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Today we have a very, very special guest, one of the greatest footballers we've ever seen in modern times, a very successful manager, and now, I think, by general agreement, the best analyst on British television. when he was
I'll argue with that.
No, when he was here, he was in the Group 1 field with John Giles and Liam Brady. Graeme Souness, it's a pleasure to welcome you to The Stand, and thank you very much for doing it.
I'm saying my pleasure, Eamon. Let's see in an hour's time if I'm still saying that.
Now, Graeme, you were born in Edinburgh. Yep. I always had the impression you were a tough Glaswegian, but no. Edinburgh is a nice posh place. Were you a posh boy?
If you call being brought up in a prefab posh, then I was posh. Now, what I was blessed, it was only something I realised later in life, that I was the youngest of three sons, and that stood me in good stead in football terms, because I always had someone to play with. Our prefab backed onto a school playing field, so I always had somewhere to play, I always had someone to play with. And the real bonus was, like in any sport, you must always play with people who are better than you if you want to improve. So I had the advantage of two older brothers, and you know, they never held anything back on me. They used to physically mess me around if I played up at all. So all those factors, I think, contributed to me being a football player.
And what did your dad do?
He was a glazier.
Really?
Yeah, he was a glazier. And I have to say that I came from the most wonderful household, really happy childhood, you know, a really solid family. And I was blessed in that respect.
Was it always going to be soccer? A professional career as a soccer player. Were you good academically at school?
I got by academically. It was always going to be football, and it's very easy for me to say now, well, I knew it was always going to happen, but I had and still have the most ridiculous confidence in myself.
Yeah,
I'm sure some of it misplaced, but it stood me in good stead when the going got tough throughout my career.
Did you play for Scotland Schoolboys?
Yeah, I played for Edinburgh Schools, the under 12. There's 4 years between me and my brother, my middle brother, then another 4 years. And I played in some of my brother's team at primary school. So when he was 12, I was 8. I can remember playing in a cup final with him and playing in his team when he had the harder games. Yeah. So I must have shown something at that age.
And that was, of course, in Scotland, football was divisive in the sense that there was Celtic and Rangers. And in Edinburgh, there Hibs was and Hearts and Hibs. Well, you were Hearts and a Rangers man.
Well, my family are all from Leith, which is down Easter Road near where the Hibs.
Yes.
My dad was a Hibs supporter.
Right.
But what I have to say, in Edinburgh, there was never, in my household anyway, there was never any religious aspect to anything.
Right.
You know, there was good people and bad people.
Yeah.
And I used to walk every day to primary school with a guy called Peter Marinello, who was a Hibs,
Chelsea, didn't he, in the end?
Arsenal. He was the new George Best.
Of course, yeah, he was.
And we would walk to school together. I think he was a year older than me, maybe 2 years older than me. And he would say goodbye at my school gate, and he'd walk around the corner to St. Joseph's, where he went to school.
Right.
And I'd wait for him to come back. So we went to school and back to school together. And the only time there's any issues between the two schools is because we shared the playground. There were snowball fights.
Okay. You know. Now, you began your career as a pro footballer with Spurs.
Yeah.
Bill Nicholson was the manager. had been one of the great managers and coaches, won the double with Spurs in 1961, League and Cup, hadn't been done for about 90 years, and certainly hadn't been done in modern times.
Let me just tell you how I ended up at Spurs. I played for I played for Scottish schools earlier. I played for Edinburgh schools, under 12. They weren't, the Nationals came in when you were under 15. So I played for the Scottish schools under 15. We played England at White Hart Lane. And the great Dave Mackay had broken his leg for the second time and was watching the game. So he's looked at the programme and he's seen as a kid that's gone to the same school as him.
Really?
So after the game, he's recommended to the scouts, you should go and keep an eye on this kid. And that's why I ended up at Spurs. And I had 4 years there. I used to drive Bill Nick mad. You know, I used to tell him, you know, it's 18, I should be in the first team. The system then was sort of three midfield players. It was Alan Mullery, who was sometimes captain of England, Martin Peters, a World Cup winner, and a young guy who was 2 years ahead of me, Steve Berman.
I know Steve Berman. I played against him, actually.
So he was a tough lad. He had a great attitude to the game.
He did, yeah. He was a great
And for the game. And I used to tell Bill Nick I was better than all three of them when I was 18, and they should be picking me. And I think eventually he got so cheesed off with me that he sold me as far from London as he possibly could, and I ended up in Middlesbrough. Sold me for $30,000.
Yeah, I remember Middlesbrough, a second division team. Then I was playing second division with Millwall. In fact, I played against you at the Den on one memorable occasion when you beat us 4-1. You became an outstanding player there. And Jack Charlton was not the manager who brought you there, but he did come into the club, didn't he?
Yes. When I went there, it was January time. Stan Anderson, who had bought me, bought me under recommendation. Well, that how I ended up, there's always a story how you end up at a football club. But Harold Shepperson, who was Sir Alf Ramsey's assistant when they won the World Cup, was assistant manager at Middlesbrough. And through sort of the England get-togethers, people like Martin Peters, Martin Chivers, Alan Mullery were saying, you know, look at this kid. You know, he's treading water at Tottenham. And then along with sort of me cheesing the manager off at every opportunity, there was never any great communication at Tottenham at that time. Bill Nick was not a great communicator.
No.
His assistant was a guy called Eddie Bailey, who was a sort of inside forward of some repute, I believe. They say he was a fabulous player.
Oh, he was a great player.
He was noisy and in your face, but Bill never said anything. And if at any time, you know, someone had said to me, look, just be patient, we think you've got a chance, I would have stayed there. I wouldn't have gone to Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
But I was at home for New Year. I get a call on the 2nd, 3rd of January that we've agreed a fee with Middlesbrough. So I said, I'm off then. I'll go. You don't want me. And that's been my attitude throughout my life.
Yeah, it was a big call because Spurs were still a big, big club and Middlesbrough weren't. Although they had been a first division club. But at that stage, they were struggling. And when they really took off was with
Jack. Jack came,
Now, tell us about Jack. How did you find Jack?
Jack was, I'm sure there's, you know, you've got as many tales about him as I have. He was very much, it's Jack's way.
It was his first job, incidentally, as a coach.
It was Jack's way or the highway. He basically, he painted a picture for me. You're a young man, it's got a bit of ability, but there's been hundreds of players like you before. There's two doors for you. One, you can go and achieve something, you might even win something. Another one, you'll just drift out of the game and just be someone else who was a near miss. And I took that on board. Jack spoke to me in a way which I responded to. It was hard, harsh.
Yeah.
It was in your face, it was aggressive, and I responded to that.
And he didn't necessarily like, I mean, you were a great player on the ball, you're a great player off the ball, but really superb footballer. Wasn't mad about the passing game.
No, he didn't like people who complicated the game, and I get that. You know, I mean, as I sort of grew up and understood the game more, I mean, a manager's job, Eamon, is to get at the best from the group of players he has.
Yes.
And come up with a system that suits that group. And we had players like John Hickton and David Mills who would run forward. Hickey would, you know, challenge for every ball with a centre half. David Mills was a flyer. He could run forward with great pace. And he wanted us to get it forward as quickly as we possibly could to those two. So, you're getting the benefit of those two, where they're the only people that really matter on a football pitch, as far as I'm concerned. Everyone else on a football pitch is there for one reason and one reason only, to give those two guys, if it is two, maybe three at times, as much time and space in the dangerous area to get your goal.
Yeah.
Everyone else in the pitch is just there for that reason.
Yeah.
It's not about showing tricks and dribbling on the halfway line and showing how clever you are on the halfway line. It's about getting the ball into them quickly. So he worked out a system that suited us. For me, I because I've been at Bilnik, passing with Bilnik, yeah, which was all pass the move. It was all about, you know, doing simple but and straightforward things at times, but you're allowed to show that you had a trick in your locker, if you like. Get to Middlesbrough, none of that. Get it forward quickly, be aggressive, and I responded to everything he was telling me, and I had 3 great years with Jack. We won the league.
You won the second division by 17 points.
We were by far the best team. We had a really good team. And then we had a really good year, I think the first year in the first division, on the Premier, as it's called today, where I think we finished fifth or sixth. And if we had spent a few bob then on the right players, we might have been able to push on. But it's a bit like today. It's never been any different. It's breaking into that top bunch is a hard part.
So how did Jack come to leave? Who left first, you or Jack?
No, Jack left. He felt he had taken it as far as he could. I think he wanted to take a year off. I mean, I'll give you an insight into Jack. Jack would sometimes, not every week, but turn up at 2:45. We've not seen him since the previous game, the week before on a Saturday. He'd turn up at 2:45. He would speak for 30 seconds and we'd go out and play.
Yeah.
And he'd leave the rest up to the coaches.
But you were well drilled to use the phrase of the...
Yeah.
And it was a good phrase.
And you know, we used to have a chuckle about it, but we were winning games, so it worked. And looking back now, I see how it can work. You know,
I mean, it's part of your nature. I mean, I remember when you were trying to get away from Spurs, that you were. I was in London myself, London Evening Standard. Soon as I should be in the team, I want to leave Spurs. 18-year-old kid, and I'm thinking, wow, you know. But
I've never underestimated myself. No, I can never be accused of that.
Other people do that for you, but. The thing about Middlesbrough that's impressive is you adapted to what Jack was saying, got on with it, and made yourself a top player. Now, you went from Middlesbrough to Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very, very big move because Liverpool were a huge club. Tell me about that.
Well, I like to think... There was a bit of background to that. When I was at Middlesbrough, Phil Boersma, who's one of my best friends in football, he'd been at Liverpool. He had Jack at bottom, and we ended up great pals living in the same digs. And he was getting calls from a guy called Bob Rockliffe, who used to run a garage in West Derby. Every morning, Bob Paisley would go into that garage to pick his horses.
Yeah.
And Bob Rockliffe would put the bets on for him.
Yeah.
So Bob was saying, it was a great pal of boys, who would say, look, Liverpool are interested, you know, they want to buy your mate.
Yeah.
So I knew there was interest from very early on.
Yeah.
And as that went on, I can remember getting a call. Leeds were interested, Man City were interested, as well as Liverpool. And
Leeds were a big club then.
Yeah. And I can remember thinking, I got a call. I was making noises I wanted to leave, and the chairman, Charlie Aymer of Middlesbrough, said, no, we're not selling them at this time. And I sort of pushed it. I know we talk about the enormous power players have today. You know, it was a transfer record between two English clubs, so it was big money in its day. It was really, it was like it is today. So I had a fair bit of leverage over them. Anyway, I get a call one day and I'm told to go to the Queen's Hotel in Leeds, where they've agreed a fee with a club. They wouldn't tell me who it was. So I've drive from Middlesbrough to Leeds in a black BMW I'd just treated myself to. Thinking I was all right, you know, tackle a lad. And I said to myself, if it's Leeds or indeed if it's Man City, I'm not going. Right. I'm only going to go if it's Liverpool.
Right.
And that might sound strange, but I lived in Diggs at 53 Chipchase Road in Linthorpe with a lady called Phoebe Haig, who's like my second mum. She used to allow me to get away with murder, but she looked after me royally. Sadly, she's no longer with us, but as daft as it sounds, and you're going to laugh at this, there was part of me thinking, I don't really want to leave.
Yes.
You know, I'm so happy.
Sure.
I was Billy Big Nuts.
Yes.
At Middlesbrough.
Yeah, yeah.
I was, the sort of most famous and, if you like,
the man.
The biggest player, yeah. So I was enjoying life in Middlesbrough. And people think of Middlesbrough as not a very nice place, but, you know, that was in the old days, ICI and British Steel, but you get out into North Yorkshire, and there's beautiful parts of Cleveland and North Yorkshire. Anyway, so I get to the Queen's Hotel, and it is Bob Paisley's there, John Smith the chairman, and Peter Robinson the secretary. So it was Liverpool, and then I ended up driving back to Liverpool with Peter Robinson in the car. I can remember him not being too happy because I was young and drove too fast. Coming to the end of the M62, when you get into Liverpool, there's a bit of a hill and then a dip, and I think maybe the front wheels just left the road as I got to the brow of this hill, and Peter Robinson gripped both sides of his seat. Yeah. So I remember that vividly, and it was I can't even remember how the discussions went in terms of what they were going to pay me. It's just, where's the contract I want to sign?
You want to
get remember, in those days, I mean, if you had a chance to go to Barcelona, Real Madrid, Man United, Bayern Munich or Liverpool, if you're a Northern European, it might have been different for Latins or Southern South Americans, but if you were a Northern European, you'd have chose Liverpool above all those.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great club still, but this was really...
They just won a European Cup for the first time.
Yes, and Paisley... tell me what you made of Paisley. I mean, he has been the most successful manager, English manager, of all time in terms of winning what's now the Champions League, what was then the European Cup.
Three times in 7 years.
And you won five
leagues.
First Division, which is now Premier League, winners' medals, and three European Cups?
Yeah.
I mean, that's extraordinary.
Well, can I just tell you to... And it's not, I'm not bragging about you, but I would like... Part of me wants to think that I was Bill Nick's biggest ever mistake.
Yes.
You know, he sells me
for
30 grand.
Four
years later, I'm sold for what was a record transfer fee between two English clubs. I'm a defensive midfield player. As it was then, as it is now, the big money goes on strikers. So,
yes.
And again, because of my personality, you know, you hear that a transfer fee is a burden to people.
Yeah.
No, I loved that. I could never say it, but I loved that. I responded to it. So then I go to Liverpool, and I'm working with Bob Paisley, who was a man of few words.
Yeah.
Then you had Joe Fagan, who was a wise old owl as well. And then
Ronnie Moran, who sadly died last week.
And I said at the time, it's something I never thought about, but Ronnie was the biggest influence on me.
Yeah,
as a player in my career.
I met him. I had the good fortune to meet him because I was playing for Manchester United reserves at Anfield one night.
You would certainly hear him.
Yeah, but he was also... I was cocky. Yeah. He's a cocky little Irish sod. Yeah. But he was a funny man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Always ready with equipment, joking, and friendly.
He was sort of the chief... Let's go to Bob Paisley first. Bob Paisley was a man who didn't say very much and... was a great judge of player.
Yeah.
You look at the players he bought. He knew his football inside out, but couldn't always express himself very well.
Mm.
And it was strange. When we got to... After he announced he was going, and he was in the last year of his... as a captain, I have to go to dinners with him, you know, where he'd be sort of making farewell speeches from Christmas onwards.
Yeah.
And I noticed a real change in him. He became such a good after-dinner speaker. He was really funny. His timing improved. His stories, he sort of embellished the stories. He just got better and better.
Yeah.
And it was in there all the time.
Yeah, he was a Geordie, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was in there all the time, the storytelling. I mean, he had quite a... You know, he was in the British Army, and his stories of North Africa were quite interesting.
And, of course, he'd been Bill Shankly's right-hand man. And Shankly was such a colourful, robust character.
He couldn't
compete
with that.
Exactly. But Paisley had...
He did it his way. Well, he's the most successful. I think it was 7 years he was there. I was lucky. I got on really well with him. I ended up... I mentioned this character.
Who was in the team when you arrived? I mean, Dalglish?
Yeah, he had bought Kenny in the summer.
Yeah.
And Alan Hansen. And then the team early on
Rush.
Would have been... No, he came later. The team early on would have been... Which arguably might have been the best Liverpool team I played in. Certainly, you know, the stats might suggest that. It would have been sort of Ray Clemens in goal, Phil Neal right back, Alan Hansen sometimes with Emlyn Hughes at centre back, and then Phil Thompson, Joey Jones at left back. Even in the early days, Tommy Smith was in the team.
Yeah.
And then a midfield, it would be Jimmy Case on the right, Ray Kennedy on the left, Terry McDermott and I in the centre,
yes,
and David Johnston, Kenny Dalglish up front.
Right. Yeah.
And I think one year we conceded. I think we conceded in one season 14 goals.
Yes.
And we won the league easily. And I think we conceded at home. So you're buying a season ticket and someone says to you, this season you're only going to see your team concede 5 goals
yes.
at home. You would say, well, you know, what have you been drinking? You're off your head.
Yeah.
We conceded 5 goals. I think it was 5 goals at home in one season. And we won the league by a country mile. And I think it's true. Not that someone will Google this, but the top goal scorer against us that year was me. I scored 2 OGs. I remember scoring one at Bolton and there was one somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I think I was the top goal scorer against us. Out of the 15, I scored 2 of them.
Tell me this. In that team, and indeed the teams you went on to play in with the likes of Ian Rush, I think you played with Ronnie Whelan.
Ronnie was a
later,
fabulous player.
Later on. Ronnie was a fabulous player, wasn't he?
Clever.
Yeah. But there's so much talked about tactics now in the game. And almost every conversation, I can see you laughing already.
Oh, because I'm going to tell you a story which people won't believe.
The thing that makes teams fabulous is great players.
Correct.
And there's no tactic that can defy that.
Mm-hmm.
You'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
100%. You've got no chance of being successful as a manager unless you've got good senior players, because you spend so little time with them. You know, you think you've got, call it 5 working days in match day. 5 working days, you've got 2 hours each day with them, 10 hours in a week, and you're in and out of their face on match days.
Yeah.
So call it a 12-hour period in a week, you can make an impression on these young men.
Yeah.
So
it's the senior pros.
Yeah, because they would then maybe go for a game of golf with them. They may, socially, they may live in the same area as them.
Yeah.
And it's the trump every day for training. I think if you look back at Fergie's success, why he kept the likes of Gary Neville on,
Steve Bruce.
I'm thinking the ones he kept on for a long time, Ryan Giggs.
Yeah.
He brought Scholes back, because every day in training they set the example. This is how we train.
Yeah.
This is what you have to do to be a top team, to win the big trophies. So he held on to them. You know, and when Ryan Giggs chucks it, he chucks it.
Right.
You know, that whole cycle ended with both of them at the same time, more or less.
Yes. Now, just going into that Liverpool dressing room with these big players, having yourself, a big presence and loads of self-confidence, did you go in and say, I'll be quiet, or did you go in full on?
Full on. I mean, I've gone in there and there was no inferiority complex. I respected them, but I knew deep down, I know I'm every bit as good, if not better than most of you. And that again, might sound terribly big-headed, but that attitude has stood me in good stead throughout my career when the going got a bit tough. And maybe life, not maybe outside of football as well. But let me tell you a story. When you're talking about the tactics and formations and managers, you know, being brilliant tacticians, like we've got several being called that in Premier League right now. I go to Liverpool. I trained from Monday to Friday. It was the warm-up was walk around the perimeter of Melwood, jog around the perimeter, a few stretches, 3-quarter pace, 6 sprints, 5-a-sides, finish them, a few sprints, and go home.
Yep.
So that's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So my first game is West Brom away from home. I'm in the dressing room at 3:15, and I'm looking around the dressing room. There's John Toshack, Steve Highway, Ray Clemens, Emlyn Hughes, Tommy
Keegan?
Smith. No, he had gone.
He replaced
Kevin with Kenny sort of 5-6 months before I got there. So I'm in the dressing room with all these players, and I'm looking around. And at 3:15, I look at the clock, I think 3:15, and Joe Fagan, I said, Joe, can I have a quick word? Yes, son. And Joe was such a cute, clever man. He spoke in such a soft voice.
Yes.
You actually had to lean into him to hear him properly. So, yeah, what is it, son? And so I've said, Joe, look, I've been here a week and no one said anything to me. How is it you want me to play football?
Yeah.
Well, Joe was not a man who used bad words.
No.
But he did. He said, F off, and a big booming voice, so now all the lads are looking at me. We've spent all this effing money on you and you're asking me how to play football, and turned and walked away. And I thought,
that's
right, I'll never ask that one again. And that, I never ever asked another question. Never asked it. But that simplifies it. I'm in the dressing room with all these players. Just look at them. Just watch them closely. And that's that was the theme throughout my time at Liverpool.
Yeah.
When you're a younger man, you're expected to look at them because the message is coming from the big guys. How you live, how you train, your attitude to training. And then when you become the term that Ronnie Moran christened, a big head.
Yeah.
A big head meant that you were a regular in the first team and you carried a bit of authority in the dressing room, the big heads.
Yes.
So when you become a big head, it was your job to pass that down. And sadly, I have to say, I left to go to Italy for 2 years, then Glasgow Rangers for 5 years. When I came back 7 years later, at the age of 39, as manager of Liverpool,
yes,
that had gone out of the dressing room.
Yes.
People had stopped passing that information down the line.
Yeah, and if we were to equate Liverpool then, the Liverpool you played for, with a team, a comparable team, you were dominant in England, you were dominant in Europe. It would be like Barcelona.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, this was before Heysel, before that tragedy, before the ban on English teams competing, and you were the Barcelona of that era.
Yeah,
won the Champions League three times.
Yeah, but I think we underperformed. When I look at the teams that knocked us out of the European Cup, come Champions League, there's teams that should never have beaten us.
Yeah, sure. But just let me make the point I was going to try and make, Graham, which is that when you look at Barcelona now, or in the wonderful years they've had since 2008, you'd be able to make assumptions about what's going on. And this goes to your work as an analyst and how important the Xavis, Iniestas are and were, and Messi, to that dressing room. So it's the same thing, isn't it? The same.
100%. Listen, Guardiola gets a job at Barcelona. The 3 years before Rijkaard had it, the 3 years they had won two La Ligas, one European Cup.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's taken over a pretty healthy situation. He's taken over a 21-year-old Messi.
Yeah.
A 23 or 24-year-old Iniesta, a 27-year-old Xavi, 28-year-old Xavi, a 29-year-old Puyol. He's taken over a fantastic situation.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who got that team at that time. You were destined to have.
I think he made one decision, Graham. I don't know if you agree with me.
He made two.
Well, one that I can identify, he took Messi off the right, wide right, and gave him a freeish role in the middle. Because I remember Messi playing against Patrice Evra in the European, and United beat them over two legs. He didn't get a kick in either leg, Messi. Because Evra I know it sounds weird.
The first thing he did, he got rid of Ronaldinho.
Yeah, and Deco.
Deco and the centre forward who ended up in England for a while. African player. Eto.
Yeah.
And they weren't putting a shift in. And he made them more energetic by the ones he brought in. But, you know, I think inheriting that situation at that time, you can only dream about that as a manager.
Right. And the Liverpool you played, that team you played in, the Leeds were around in the same era.
Yeah, they had just tailed off. They were coming to the end.
And Ferguson was now...
He was still at Aberdeen. There was no Man United. That was always a great fear. Peter Robinson said to me when I went back as manager, the great fear is that if that lot along the East Lancs Road, which he meant Man U, ever get their act together. Because you know, you were there, Man United is a monster football club.
Yes.
You know, enormous appeal throughout the world.
Yeah. Now, you went to Sampdoria after Liverpool. Why? It was an unusual move.
Well, I was 31. I'd been captain for 3 years, won the league each year. I was captain. Won three European Cups, won four League Cups. I was captain of my country, captain of Liverpool. Why would I go?
Well, let me ask you before you tell me about Sampdoria, about Ali McLeod and the World Cup.
That was 1978. You went
to with Scotland, and Ali McLeod had been Scottish team manager. And before you left your training camp, he said,
We're
going to win the World Cup. And everyone laughed because he was a likeable.
He was a dreamer, a lovely man.
But a dreamer.
Yeah, a lovely man. I felt a bit of a sort of outsider. I was in that group. I got into the 40 for the 74 World Cup in West Germany, with the likes of, you know, Billy Bremner, Dennis Law. And then in 78, and I didn't make the final 22. But in the 78, I did. I'd just gone to Liverpool sort of 6 months before. But they had the team that qualified them for the World Cup, you know, the midfielder, Bruce Rioch, Don Masson.
Yes.
He's at Hartford. So I went to Argentina. I was not going to be in the first 11.
Right.
I can remember the night we're flying out of Prestwick, there was a farewell in Hampden. There was about 40,000 people turned up. We were in an open deck bus going round Hampden, and I was sort of trying to keep a low profile. This is all a little bit embarrassing. I'm not, you know, had nothing to do with this, getting to Argentina, but I'm here. So anyway, we went to Argentina, and as you know,
yeah,
Ali had got the whole nation excited. You know, we're gonna win the World Cup. You know, yeah. Scotland won. No European nation like had won a European Cup in South America at that time until Brazil did last time out in Brazil. Until West Germany did in Brazil, sorry. West Germany, show me age. Germany did in Brazil. So we went there full of, you know, high expectation. And in the very first game, we got beat by Peru or Chile, 3-1.
Yeah.
And then we drew 0-0 with Iran. And I can remember I was on the bench, and it's 0-0. And Ali McLeod's looking along. Was it 1-0 or was it 1-1 or 0-0 against Iran? Anyway, I can remember Ali McLeod looking along the bench to bring someone on. Every time he looked down the bench, everyone on the bench would look the opposite way so he couldn't catch his eye. No one wanted to be involved in it. And then we drew that game. And then the third game we're playing, we ended up being finalists, Holland. And we're beating them 3-1 with about 10 minutes to go. And if we make it 4-1, we're going to go through to the next group stages. So
it ended up 3-2, I think.
3-2. I think Johnny Rep lashed one in from about 30 yards.
Yeah, there was a wonderful little player, played for Preston, who made a goal for Scotland.
Archie Gemmell.
Yeah, I think he's dead now, Archie.
No, he's still alive.
He's still alive. Yeah, I played against Archie.
Yeah, you would have done. Yeah, Archie was quite feisty.
Yeah.
Archie actually accused me of being made of chocolate. He didn't say it to my face, but he wrote somewhere, if he was made of chocolate, he'd eat himself.
Yeah.
And Archie was 100% right when I was a young man.
Yeah.
No argument with that. But okay. Archie, I think you finally got a really cute pass to go on that run as well.
I think you're still in that zone. But anyway, stars are allowed to be like that. Sampdoria, was it time to make a few quid and experience?
Well, I was married, as I said, I was captain of my country, captain of Liverpool, just won the European Cup. Won the league cup. We'd done the treble at Liverpool. I was married to a woman at the time who was about to inherit some money, and she had to get out of the country, so that's why I went.
Right.
Signed a 3-year deal, spent 2 years there. You know, at 31, I've gone there with an attitude that if it doesn't work, I can always come back and play for somebody else. And I went there and thoroughly enjoyed it. At that time, Serie A was like, in the 80s, it was like what the Premier League is now.
Yeah.
It was paid the best wages, and all the big players were there.
How did you find football there?
Doddle.
Yeah, well, funny, I asked the same question when I interviewed Liam Brady, and Liam had gone to Juventus, and he said exactly the same thing.
It was easy.
He said, loads of time, space.
For a midfield player, it was easier.
Yes.
Because what would happen, you'd get the ball, so you wouldn't have the ball, and you'd retreat. So the other team had time and space on it. Well, as a midfield player in England, you're used to having someone up your backside, you know, wanting to leave a bit on you every opportunity. You couldn't get turned. When I went to Italy, they allowed you to turn and make passes. It was very easy.
Yeah. Now, your move into management was a big one, to manage Rangers.
Yeah, just going back to Italy, Sampdoria were a young team, and the reason they bought me, they are a young team, and they brought me to sort of be the...
They met some very good players over the years, didn't they?
Well, Viali was there, but he was 19. Mancini would have been 18, 19.
Yeah.
Vieck would have a really good centre-back.
Yeah.
We had some... Trevor Francis was there.
Yeah.
We had some good players. And then we won the Italian Cup in the first year, the first time I'd won a trophy.
Yeah.
So, and that team went on, if you remember, to get to a European Cup final at Wembley, losing to Barcelona the first time Barcelona won the European Cup. So anyway, so I'm there. I signed for 3 years, and then after 2 years, I get the chance to go back and manage Rangers.
Yeah,
I'd never grew up as a Rangers supporter, didn't really go and watch them a lot other than midweek games and European nights, because on a Saturday I play for my school, then my boys' club. So I was never a great watcher of football, but I must have gone there maybe 20 times. So I'd class myself as a Rangers supporter.
Just before we leave your playing career, Graham, I mean, you were a hard player, and Giles was a very hard player, would you agree?
Yes.
Not known for it.
You have to be very careful if you're playing against Johnny Giles.
And this is a question I want to ask you, because I see so many bad tackles now, and I'm thinking, to a recent tackle here when Seamus Coleman got done by young Taylor, a Welsh fullback. I think the game is pretty wicked now. But John says, don't be stupid. When Souness was around and I was around, and, Peter Storey at Arsenal, Chopper Harris at Chelsea, and all of that. I mean, do you think it was a much harder game, physically dirty, then than it is now?
Yeah.
And you were right in there, weren't you?
Yeah, for a number of reasons. I think there was more cynicism then. There was more of... Every team had someone that you had to be careful of.
Yeah.
And then you're talking about Johnny Giles, there's maybe four or five in his team.
Did you play against John?
Yeah, I was a young man, maybe 19, 20, played at Middlesbrough. And I've tried to be aggressive to him and Bremner. And I can remember I went out to get, there was a short free kick taken, and I've just sort of helped it on as it's been played to me. Someone takes it, it's played to me. I've helped it on, and I end up kicking the bottom of Johnny Giles's left or right foot.
Which he'd left.
It was a stinger, it was a sore one. Yeah. And then I remember in the same game, as I said, I was obviously talking too much and going after the wrong people, because I got sorted out in that game. Really the only time in my career. And that was by Terry Urath. So I'd been aggressive to Jalsey and Bremner, and one of them was going to have a dip at me. And I've gone for a ball with Bremner, and as my right foot landed, Terry Urath came and caught me on the outside of my knee. It was a lesson well learned, and after that, I think prior to that, you think you're the meanest, toughest guy out there.
Yeah.
But after that, you learn to pick and choose when you leave yourself exposed. And I never ever got caught once by Paul Marner when I went to Liverpool, but nothing like that. Just stitches. And then you learn to pick and choose your battles. When you're favourite, if you're not favourite. And there's the remotest chance that guy might think he can leave a bit on you. Because, as I said, every team had one, two, three of those types. So I was careful after that, and I picked my battle.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Okay, Rangers. What Celtic were the dominant team. It was a two club league, although Alex Alex Ferguson had broken that with Aberdeen, hadn't he? He'd broken that sort of duopoly that dominated Scottish football.
And it was Dundee United as well, under Jim McLean.
Yeah.
So, and Hearts were strong as well.
Yeah. So when you went there, what did you find?
Well, I found a club that, you know, the gates were down to 18,000. They hadn't won the league for 9 years. And they were drifting.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, again, because of the personality, thinking, you know, being a player, I've won big trophies, I've played for my country, I understand football. But you don't understand football until you, not management anyway, until you go to the other side.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there's a terrible feeling of responsibility, and when it doesn't go well, you feel you've let people down and lonely.
You started as player manager, didn't you, Dan?
Player manager, but and I got sent off in my very first game, which was at Easter Road, Hibs Ground. I remember getting sent off, and as I'm walking off, I look into the front row of the director's box. Now, this Easter Road was a ground that my dad used to sneak into to play football on at night when he was a kid. And I look at him, and his head's down, he can't look at me. And again, you know,
tough moment.
Yeah, and the press from England had come up to watch this, and I just gave them the most wonderful copy.
Yeah, yeah.
Great day for the media that day.
Yeah.
But we went on to win the league that year, and then the 5 years I was at Rangers, we won four leagues. We did well there.
Created
a good team.
And turned the whole thing on its head, because Celtic had been dominant. One of the things you did there was sign a Catholic. Mm. And I have been to Ibrox. I was there actually the day they unveiled Paul Gascoigne. Mm-hmm. I just went to try and get him to let me write his book, actually. But I'll tell you that story some other time. He had an agent, horrible little fella. I brought books I'd written.
Was that Stein?
Yeah.
Stein.
Yeah. And I'd written a biography of you two, a biography of Matt Busby, and my own little book. And I was bringing these so that Paul could read them to see
that
I wasn't...
Good pictures in there, were there?
No, that I wasn't one of those journalists who destroyed people they wrote books about. And I went up to Melstein. Was his name, while Paul was doing this press thing. And I said, Mr. Stein, how are you? And he says, what are you doing here, mate? Oh, I saw you playing for Millwall. What are you doing now? So I said, well,
I think you're in there.
I'm a journalist. Yeah, it's not much good. I said, I'm a journalist. I said, I've written a couple of books, and I just wondered if Paul would be interested, or you and Paul, in letting me, you know, do his biography, because I think he's such a great player and it's a good story. And I said, he said, what's in the bag? I said, well, I've actually brought books along that he can read to reassure him in case he thought I'd do a hatchet job on him. Oh, I mean, he says, don't be fucking silly. Paul doesn't read books. So I didn't get the gig.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, one of the things that struck me that day were the pictures of the Queen and the distinctly, overtly Protestant thing vibe,
but it's not such
in
a
the
bad
ground.
Thing. It's not such a bad thing to have a picture of the Queen.
No, not at all. I'm very fond of the Queen, but it just was. It was. I'd never been in a football ground because I went to, the director's room and did a little tour of it. However, the question I'm going to ask you is about Mo Johnson, who was a Celtic player, a Catholic, and you had the guts and the fortitude and the courage. Sign him.
What happened with Rangers managers prior to me, on the very first day of your press conference, the third question and fourth question then would be, would you sign a Catholic? And of course every manager prior to me said, yeah, of course I would. And then I was asked a question and I think they got the same response. I said, yeah, if the right one came along, I'd definitely do it. And you get the journalists, certainly from the East End side of Glasgow, that team down there, their supporters would roll their eyes and say, yeah, really, we've heard all this before. So a few years later, there's a picture appears in the Evening Times in Glasgow, Maurice Johnson with Billy McNeil and a Celtic shirt being held up against them. He's coming back from Nantes.
Yes.
And two or three days later, we were at home at Ibrox playing a game. I walked down the stairs and I was walking around to the left where the dressing rooms were, and over to the right there's a radiator. Bill McMurdo, Morris's agent, sitting leaning against the radiator. As I walked down, I didn't stop, it was just over my shoulder. I said, Bill, you should have let us know about Morris, we would have been interested. And as I take another 10 steps, he's actually on my shoulder now, just before I'm pushing the door to go into the dressing room area. Do you mean it? I said, yeah, come with me. So I took him into the little office I had there. I said, yeah, I'd be interested. And then that's how it developed. And we ended up signing him. And
An absolute sensation.
Yeah, well,
He took an enormous stick. Took an enormous stick.
But I tried to get Ray Houghton before. And he didn't fancy it. I tried to get, John Collins.
Yes.
He didn't fancy it. You know, he did originally, but then...
Because they probably knew what they were going to be in for.
Yeah, I think, well,
Mo Johnson was... Yeah.
He was and that's why Morris deserves a great deal of credit.
Yeah.
But I come back to it. And, you know, when I asked that question in the press conference, and I said, yeah, I'll sign it. I said, look, I'm married to a Catholic woman. My kids are Christian Catholic. So you're saying... I can be married and have children, christened, but I can't work with any Catholic. I said, I will do it if the right one comes along.
And how much hostility did you feel around your own club?
Well, there was reservations. Obviously, I had to run it past David Murray. He sort of hesitated briefly, to be fair to him. He said, let's do it. Yeah, it took him maybe 10 seconds and a couple of deep breaths to agree to it.
Right.
But he knew, and we all knew it was the right thing to do.
And how did the media react? There's sectarianism there as well, isn't there?
Yeah. Obviously, the Celtic supporters in the media weren't too happy. It's not the right thing to do. And there were some religious people in Glasgow on the Catholic side said it wasn't a good thing.
Did his form suffer?
No, he was fabulous for me.
He was?
Yeah, he was fabulous for me. And he's the one out of all of it deserves the most credit because he, you know, I come back to it, maybe why... John Collins wouldn't come because his family lived in Scotland.
Sure, absolutely. No.
So Morris was prepared to do all that.
Did you sign a black Catholic?
No, I signed. I tried to get the whole sort of spectrum
so
there. I signed Abby Cohen, the late Abby Cohen, unfortunately, a Jewish lad.
Yes.
And I signed Mark Walters, who's a black guy from Aston Villa.
Right.
And all did really well for
him. Because racism was also a thing associated with Rangers.
Yeah, but
not with you.
But I come back to it. You know, it's never been part of my life and never will be. It's not the way I was brought up. They were good players, right time. Let's do it.
Now, just while we're talking about sectarianism, religion, and associated matters, a little known fact about you, Graham, that you have a strong connection with this country. Because your wife is related to one of our great icons, Dickie Rock.
Yeah, my mother-in-law, who's, you know, they say you should always check out your future wife by seeing what the mother looks like. Well, I did that. And I'm married to a very beautiful woman, but she gets the look from her mother. And maybe her dad's involved, but my mother-in-law is a beautiful woman. And her cousin is Dickie Rock. So there's an Irish connection there.
Did you ever hear him sing?
I heard his records, of course.
Oh, yeah.
I've met him several times.
He's a magical singer. Did you meet Dickie?
I've met him, yeah.
Yeah, he used to drive around town in a roller when times were tough.
Yeah, well.
I like him. But
he's very famous here, isn't he?
Oh, geez, yeah, he's a legend. He's an Irish icon. I mean, there's not many. There's only one Dickie. And, you know, the girls used to shout at the dancers, Dickie, spit on me. That was enough.
He had a couple of shows. He was doing a couple of shows.
He still gigs and you still see him on the Late Show.
So I dine out on that. I brag about that every opportunity.
Now, you went from Rangers, where you did an amazing job over a period of 5-6 years, back to your old club, Liverpool, to manage them. There were still some players at the club that you'd played with.
Yep.
And, of course, they were getting quite old now.
Well, there were the vast majority...
It didn't go well, did it?
No, it was a tough job. The job was always a job I was going to get offered at some time. And I, you know, given the start I'd had at Glasgow Rangers, thought, I can turn around any job.
Yes.
You know, before I go to Liverpool, you know, they had 2 years they hadn't won anything. The squad, the vast majority of them were over 30, 31. and they were on the wane. And, you know, it was post-Hillsborough. These players had been going to 10, a dozen funerals a day for a fortnight.
Yes.
Must have been so tough on them.
Yes.
And, you know, that had left a mark on them. And I believe that Kenny resigned because he couldn't say goodbye to those players.
That's what people say, yes.
You know, it would have been so tough for him to say, look, your time's up here. Anyway, I walk in the door thinking, you know, I'm the solution to the problems. And made big mistakes. There's one very obvious one. I took it as a real compliment. Peter Robinson, the chief executive, and you'd have to say is responsible. You have to put him up there with Shankly, Paisley, Fagan.
Yes, Moran. I met Phil Rhodes. He's a very nice man.
As yeah. being responsible for their glory years, because he ran the club. He would be the chief executive today, but he was still the secretary. Anyway, he said to me, do you want to do contracts? And by that, it means, you know, do you want to speak to the players about what they're getting and what they're not getting? Because I'd done everything at Glasgow Rangers, I said, yeah, I'll do that. That was schoolboy error, because if you imagine it happened to me with Rushy. I signed Dean Saunders. He finds out what Dean Saunders is getting on. Rushy knocks on the door. He says, you got to pay me the same money as what Dean Saunders on. I said, well, you know, money's just gone crazy now. The bigger transfer fees. Yeah. He said, and I'm having to say no to him on a Wednesday.
Yes.
You know, one of the greatest strikers the club's ever had.
Yes.
And then on the Saturday, 3 days later, I'm saying, you've got to give me everything today, Rushy. You've got to give me everything. So, you know, I'd made a mistake with that. The other big mistake I made, I had people, four in particular, who came to me and said, look, I'm 31, I'm nearly 32, I've got a chance for a 3-year contract somewhere else, can I go? What I should have said, Eamon, was, I hear what you're saying, and when the time's right, when I can get someone in to replace you, you can go. My attitude then was, why would you want to leave Liverpool? Is there something wrong with you?
Yeah,
you know, Liverpool for me was still the biggest and best club in the world to play for. So I would say to them, tell you what, get them to ring me this afternoon and you can go tomorrow. And I'll fill out with those players, because they were...
Right.
It was the wrong attitude by me. I should have been cuter. So I was selling players maybe that had a year left in them and or certainly come on as a sub and be an impact for me. And then I was going out in a rush to replace them.
Phil Thompson was he was in charge of Liverpool's reserve team, and famously, you and he didn't get on, to put it mildly.
Yeah, basically, I think it would go back.
You'd played with each other and hadn't got on?
Yeah, no. We had an incident, funnily enough, here in Dublin, where I've thrown a pint of lager over him in a bar one night.
Yeah.
And then I think it sort of, you know, that can happen when young men are out and there's drink involved. And I think maybe it started from his side when we signed Mark Lawrence and were attempted to play three at the back in pre-season. And I've said, I can remember, you know, we were getting beat 3-0 by the kids at Melwood in a training game. And I said, hey, listen, we've always played four at the back. What are we doing? Are we playing this way to just accommodate people?
Yes.
We're changing our whole system that's brought us success. So we ended up, you know, he ended up being out of the team. And then latterly, the captaincy was taken away from him by Bob Paisley and given to me. So that's where the bad feeling would be. But then I have to say, subsequently, we now made up, but there was, you know, a good decade where I would have nothing to do with him. And I think justified, and I'll tell you why I think it's justified. I'm in hospital, having just had open heart surgery. He was in the boot room after we had played Man United and beaten them 2-0. I remember it. Ironically, it was the first time Rushy had scored against Man United.
Really?
I think he got both goals at Anfield that day. And that sort of killed their chances of winning the league. It was the year before they won the league. In Fergie's term, I think Leeds had won earlier in the day.
That's right,
at Sheffield.
Yeah.
United, I believe, or Wednesday. And then we were playing Man United. Man United had to come to Anfield and beat us to stay in the race.
Yeah, yeah.
And tosh, Rushy got two goals. After the game, Fergie's in there in the boot room, along with Brian Kidd, Ronnie Moran was there, Roy Evans was there, and Tomo was there. And Tomo was piping on about, we've changed this, we've done that, we shouldn't have done that, we should have done this. Afterwards, Brian Kidd phoned up Archie Knox, who used to be at Man United, who was then back at Rangers with Walter Smith, and relayed the story to Archie. He said, you've got to tell Walter to tell Graham, because what happened today in the boot room was not good and should never have happened. That would have been relayed on the Sunday. On the Monday, Walter drove from Glasgow to where I was in hospital in Cheshire and relayed the story to me.
Yeah.
And I said, well, he's left me with no option. So when I got to hospital, I sacked him.
Just to about that time, Graham.
Well, I have to say, subsequently, we have made up, and I'm sure that's something he wishes
sure.
he hadn't
it
done.
Happens.
You know, as a manager, I'm you know, I want 100% loyalty. I don't want someone and against our biggest historical rivals. It shouldn't have taken place.
No.
And I'm sure if he's using it, he would regret that.
Now, one of the worst things that happened to you was when you had that heart attack.
Mm.
You were in hospital. You had a photograph taken with your wife, and it was published in The Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And The Sun is a no-go after...
Big time. It's not one of the worst things, Damon. It's by far the worst thing happened.
Yeah, I know it's a terrible thing, because it went on, and it was very lurid and horrible. And just to explain to our listeners who may be younger and not remember, that The Sun had alleged that at Hillsborough, at that tragedy, it wasn't the police who were at fault, it was the victims who were drunk.
Which
it was a horrible time.
And totally disproven.
Yes, it's been totally disproven. And The Sun is not welcome in Liverpool to this day, and even working. But it was believed that you'd given this paper, which was, you know, an exclusive for their front page for money. That was the allegation.
Yeah. Well, can I give you a bit of background to it? What happened? They got the story that I was having this operation. There was an article appeared in The Sun. That was fine, no problems. Because at that time, there was current Liverpool players that I was managing were doing columns in The Sun.
Yes.
And there was players, ex-players, one in particular, who's a arch critic of mine, Tommy Smith.
Yes.
And if you want to go into it, I'll give you a reason why we became less friendly than I'd been with other players. But so when I'm manager of Liverpool, I see people dealing with The Sun.
Yes.
So then we get to my operation, and I foolishly agreed to give them an exclusive to write a story. That's fine.
Yeah.
3 weeks later, we're playing in the semi-final replay against Portsmouth of the FA Cup. It's a Monday night game. It's at Aston Villa's ground. They'd said to me, I'm in hospital post-operation, can we have a photograph after the game? I said, you can have a photograph as long as we win. So I'm there with my wife. The game, the photographer's there in the hospital. I'm watching the game. The game goes to extra time on the Monday night. It then goes to penalties on the Monday night. And then we win on penalties. I have a photograph taken. The idea was they were going to put that in on the Tuesday.
Right.
So they missed the deadline because of the extra time and penalties. So it can't go in on the Tuesday. So they then put in on the Wednesday. Now remember, I'm still in hospital. I nearly died with the operation. I had no awareness of things that were happening outside.
Absolutely.
So they put the picture on the Wednesday, and my bit of real bad luck was that Mike Ellis, who was a local journalist for The Sun in the Northwest, he had gone on holiday. So the newspaper in London had put this picture on the front page on the Wednesday. So two things conspired against me. One, that Mike Ellis was on holiday. Another one was the penalties, extra time missed the deadline.
How tough.
And after that I was reasonably popular with the supporters as a player.
Yes.
They were giving me time as a manager. I think the vast majority knew it was a difficult job. But after that, I should have resigned.
Mm.
I should have resigned after the FA Cup final. You know, the writing was on the wall for me in terms of the support I was getting from the club.
Did you lose the cup?
No, we won the cup.
You won the cup.
We won the cup. What happened? We played open heart surgery. It was 25 years ago, last Thursday, I had this operation.
Mm.
So what happens? It's generally a 10-day and you get out.
Yes.
Well, I ended up being in 28 days because I ended up having to be opened up again. They open you up in those days. Today, they would sort of fire a stent in to most of the blocked arteries, unless it was in a very difficult place. You couldn't get a stent in. So in those days, they opened me up. So they opened me up and I ended up getting an infection. So after 10 days, I collapse. I have to be reopened again and I end up spending 28 days in the hospital. So when I get on the 28th day, it's a Friday, and the next day is the FA Cup final against Sunderland at Wembley. So there was no arrangements made for me to get from my hospital to down to the hotel in Hertfordshire. So I ended up having to get a taxi to Manchester Airport and then a fly from Manchester Airport down to Heathrow, and then have to arrange a taxi to take me from Heathrow out to the hotel. So, you know, the writing was on the wall that the club had distanced themselves from me then.
Yes.
What I should have done is seen the cup final out and then resigned after that.
Yeah.
Because that's, to this day, and I get it, and I'm a big boy and I have to take my medicine, I get it 100% why there be an element of the Liverpool sport will never accept my story.
Yes.
No. And it's something I have to live with.
It's circumstances. You went on to manage Graham a lot and successfully as well. One in particular that many people might know about and many people may not is you managed in Turkey, Galatasaray.
Yeah.
You did something there that was extraordinary and it made headlines around the world. And you can tell
Just going back to my management, my terrific career as a player, won lots of stuff. I won 11 trophies in 3 different countries as a manager.
Oh, I know that. Yeah, in Portugal.
You know, so people sort of judge me and as a sort of the idea that Liverpool was such a disaster that, you know, that sort of
that's
the flavour of my managerial career. But we did win the FA Cup.
Yes,
they would take the FA Cup right now, wouldn't they?
It sure would.
You know, in 2.5 years, we won the FA Cup at a time when the club was in a very difficult place. So yeah, I had eight jobs as a manager. I was only ever sacked 3 times. But you asked me about Turkey. I go to Turkey after Liverpool. I take 18 months out. I'm offered a job at Turkey when I go there at Galatasaray in Turkey. When I go there, the way it is in Turkey, it was a great job. And that, you know, you look at managers today, and I think Pochettino's one, I think Guardiola's one, who's walked into great situations.
Yes.
Pochettino, both at Southampton. When you look at the players that have left Southampton for big money, lots of them go to Liverpool. And other places, and then you look at his job when he gets to Tottenham. Great job to have at that time. The young players again emerging, and you look at Guardiola, the 2 jobs he's, 3 jobs he's had now. Yep. So I'll get to a long-winded way of getting there, but I'll go to Turkey. The way it is in lots of countries, most countries, is that the board gets a term. They're elected, they get a term. In Turkey, I think it's 3 years. The board asked me if I'd be interested in signing a year's contract because they were in the last year of their contract. So I go there and I'm photographed, and then it's a bit like Rangers and Celtic, Arsenal, Tottenham, Man U.
First passion.
Liverpool. Yeah, rivalry. A vice president of Fenerbahce, who are Galatasaray's big rivals, he writes, what are Galatasaray doing signing a cripple? And he was referring to me. So 2 years before having had open heart surgery. So that stuck in my mind. A year later, we'd win the cup in their stadium, and the players all run down to our supporters who are behind one goal. A big giant Galatasaray flag is handed over the barbed wire fence. All the players take a turn to wave it. It's handed to me. I take a turn to wave it. I now look to hand it to somebody else. The players now have run back up to the halfway line to get their hands on the cup. So I'm left with this big flag. So I'm now jogging back up to the halfway line. When I see a big flag, Eamon, it was a big flag.
I saw the pictures.
And I look into the stand, which are emptying. I see the director's box, and I can see this guy's face. So the mischief in me says, I'll show you who's a cripple. So I ran to the centre circle, planted this flag, and thought, a great idea that was. But the minute I planted it and turned round, I'm seeing all the supporters now climbing over the fence to get onto the pitch to wish me goodwill, obviously. I find a bit of pace from somewhere, and I get up the tunnel, and I'm underneath the perspex shields of the police, and the coins are bouncing and bottles are bouncing off these shields, and I get into the tunnel, and the tunnel might have been 40 yards long, 30 yards long, and I'm thinking, I just got away with that. And just as I thought that, I got a clump on the side of the head, a supporter got into the tunnel. So I'm having a bit of a brawl with a guy in the tunnel, and I get into the dressing room. I'm sitting in the dressing room, my right fist in an ice bucket, and I'm thinking, when the directors come down, they'll have a plane ticket in their hand and they'll be saying, get yourself home tomorrow. When they came down, that a lot of them had tears in their eyes. They were saying, it's the greatest thing that's ever happened to Galatasaray. Yeah. They'll be remembered forever. And I've never kissed so many men in my life. And you have to understand, it's a bit like the Irish, the Celtic thing, where
macho
to us. And it went down very well. And so I'm loved, deeply loved by one part of Istanbul now, but hated another half. So
well, I just
have to be careful where I go on
Istanbul. I just want
now
to thank you very much, Graham, for doing this interview because, you know, we all do here.
When are we doing the second half? Well, that's just half of it.
I know it is half of it. The one thing I want to finish by asking you is about your time as a soccer analyst for Sky, the work you do for the Sunday Times, and of course you worked, you're working for TV3 now, and you worked with us in RTE, and we had great pleasure when you were there. A new voice, a shrewd observer, and we enjoyed it immensely. I take it you did as well.
Yeah, I hope you did. And I say this, I'm not saying this because I'm in your company, I learned, you know, I think it's a bit like a player. Even when you're 30, you turn up to train, you're still learning. Yeah. The minute you don't want to learn or you think you know everything, you're done. The same applies to the job I do now. I work with young guys. I think I learn things from them. When we work together, yourself and Johnny and Liam, I think, I'd like to think maybe there was a sentence I said in 4 or 5 years we worked together that you might have stuck in your mind. That certainly was the case in reverse. There's things you would say, Johnny would say, or Liam would say, that, no, I never thought of it. It's not that you've not heard it before, or what, you're coming at it from a different angle, and something would stick in your mind, and that was certainly the case when I worked for you guys. I enjoy the work I do. I'm very lucky that you know, I started as a 15 year old, although I had less doubt than most 15 year olds about becoming a professional footballer. There's still an element of doubt, so it means that I've got, you know, I'm still 63 and I'm still earning money from football. I played with great players. I'm thinking of Liverpool in particular, where at 32 their career's over.
Yes.
Now their income now is going on match days to to walk around the tables.
Ambassadors and all that.
You know, walk around and speak to, in these fancy prawn sandwich lounges that Roy Keane called them. I'm very lucky, and I enjoy what I do. 10 years ago, I decided management was no longer for me. I didn't want to be beholden to the type of people that run football clubs now. And I accept I'm of a generation where I find the attitude of some of the players, not all of them, disturbing. I choose that word carefully, disturbing.
Yeah.
You know, they're entitled to this fantastic lifestyle that football now gives them. They stopped learning a long time ago.
One last question, Graham. In a fantastic footballing life you've had, but who's the best player you ever played with, and who was the best player you ever played against?
Same person. At the end of my first year in Italy, they picked a top Undici, that's 11 in Italian.
Yeah.
And we played a charity game against, unbelievably, Verona, who had won the league that year. The Preben Elkjær, remember the Danish striker?
Yeah.
And the big German midfield player, Hans-Peter Briegel. And a really good team, and they won the league. So we went there, and there's people, you know, Junior was there, the Brazilian, and Platini, and Boniek. They picked out, I mean, it was a proper, and we, there was a guy playing called Zico, who had played against for Brazil.
Yeah, so now played the 78 World Cup.
Now I'm playing with him. I played against him in the World Cup Championship in Tokyo when we went there with Liverpool. Played against him in the World Cup, 82, he's playing from Brazil, that arguably the best team that's never won a World Cup.
Yeah.
And, played against him at Udine. They did a couple of things at Udine, which just, you know,
beautifully balanced.
Yeah, I'd just not seen him before. He was all there. He had thighs that, I mean, maybe stocky.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe 5'9". And so I'm now playing with him. So if you imagine, you're in midfield, he's in front of me, he's received the ball, he's watched the ball arrive, he's controlled it beautifully. But my head's up all the time. I can see the picture he's about to get as he raises his head. So I've said, go on then. That's the pass out in my head. That's it out there to the left. Time and time again, when that happened, he picked a different pass to what picture I saw.
Yeah.
And I thought, I've never witnessed that before. I'm on the pitch with this guy who is just seeing a completely different picture to me.
So he was it.
And then when I played against him, there's only two players, and you'll appreciate this, two players I played against, because part of the game was, in our day, intimidation. If you could, if you're playing against, especially the special players, you like to try and let them know you were maybe physically stronger.
Yeah.
There's two players I never laid a glove on. He was one, and I'm going to ask you the question, who was the other one? A midfield player that played for Arsenal in England.
Liam Brady?
No. England he played for.
Arsenal, England. Oh, sorry.
Red hair. You'll get him. Oh. World Cup winner, man.
Alan Ball.
Yeah.
I knew Alan. Never played against Alan.
Never laid a finger on him.
No,
just too,
I played against
too
Alan
smart.
When I was a kid. He was the same age as me, actually.
Too smart.
Yeah, very smart and nice guy, too.
Yeah.
Graham, thank you very much for
no,
that.
No, it's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's great for our
we'll
listeners.
We'll do the second half sometime.
We will do a second half. And for everyone listening, that's Graham Souness. Great player, great analyst, and a good guy.
Thanks.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.